Welcome to Keep the Hotel Empty. Today we've kept the hotel empty to welcome in master ontologist and author of The Sovereign Way, Elizabeth. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're so glad to have you. I know that you got a lot going on, and I know there's a lot you want to get into, but I kind of want to start, if you can give me a little bit of the framework of discussing what The Sovereign Way is, and then I want to kind of find out how your journey got us to this point.
All right. Well, there are two answers to what The Sovereign Way is. The first answer, the easiest answer, is that The Sovereign Way is this wonderful book, which is an ontology. An ontology is a framework of thought, or if you like, it's like a model of understanding or a way of arranging the dots of what we already innately know to help us join those dots of things that are potentially ineffable, esoteric, difficult to express. So ontology provides us with a language and a model for communicating the things that we all sort of innately know about who we are and what's going on around here. It's a beautiful book. It's written in a language that is fairly unique and fairly different from most spiritual conversations, but a language that you'll nonetheless understand. And it's also soaked in a beautiful vibration that you'll recognize, because that's also innate. So that's the easy answer. The Sovereign Way is this book. The longer answer to what The Sovereign Way is that there is actually an integrated and coordinated group of world servers, or people who have a calling upon their life, or who have chosen and been chosen to represent a vibration or a dimension of being that is knowing that the truth is love and that love is the truth. And The Sovereign Way is the way that we go, those of us who belong to this generation of spiritual pioneers. We go the Sovereign Way. It's a path of becoming, it's a path of mastery and healing that meanders above all known religions and ideologies. It's one that transcends the borders and the frameworks of ontology, if you like. And the Sovereign Way, I mean, the word sovereign really means to be free, doesn't it? It means to have the highest amount of power and authority that is available to you, that's not related to mainstream ideas or the whims of the world or the rules and regulations of whatever trending religious outlook is at the moment. To be sovereign is to be mentally and vibrationally free to move according to love, The Sovereign Way. So that's the longer answer about what The Sovereign Way is. And this book called The Sovereign Way is a description both of that path, and it's sort of like a theological model, if you will, for understanding consciousness, energy, and manifestation in a modern landscape.
What do you think are some of the things about the understanding of consciousness and things in that arena that the things that are more concrete and more rigid, I don't want to say have gotten wrong, but have maybe kept certain lines of thinking held back at?
You know, there's this beautiful saying in the Bible that goes, and I'm paraphrasing because I can't remember it exactly, but it goes something along the lines of, there is a way that seems to be the right way and we follow it until we discover that it leads to death. And really, I think the constructs that hold us back are the constructs themselves. It'll always be that way. Truth is not definable.
Right.
Truth is transcendent of any words that we could use or any ontology or religion that we could put together to try to define it. However, those constructs do create linear ways of relating to one another. Even though truth is ineffable and I can never really know who God is, I can create an understanding and I can communicate that with you using linear languaging, using imagery that I've made up in my mind or stories from my past that include some facts and exclude other facts. So everything I ever share with you will be subjective and incomplete. But what really holds us back is when we make the mistake of thinking that truth is confined to those constructs.
Right.
that's where we're held back, when we make the mistake of thinking this language is correcter than your language, or this imagery or mythology or cosmology or Genesis is better or higher or truer than the one that you've been equipped with through your life. That's where we're held back. So I don't think there's necessarily any religion or any school of thought or philosophy that in and of itself is confining. It's the error that those things hold the truth within them. That's what's confining. That's the error.
What do you think it is in people that have a propensity to find, I hate to say comfort, but what do you think is the propensity of people to want to be in one of those rigid things and not feel like you're being held back by it? What's the get to living in one of those boxes that you see wanting to get past?
Oh, that's a brilliant question. And it really comes down to, well, I want to use the word lineage. I want to honor the fact that there are lineages of thought. There are generations and ancestries of understanding. And everyone's allowed to choose a path, right? We're always going to gravitate and congregate into these little cultures and subcultures with people we resonate with, who think and feel the way that we do, and who identify with the different constructs and mythologies that help us understand ourselves. So we're always going to find a box to be in, and that's okay. What liberates us from the box is the log of consciousness that allows us to know that truth is transcendent. So in the 1980s, there was a consciousness researcher called Dr. David Hawkins. And he and his team of applied kinesiologists discovered that there's a way to calibrate logs of consciousness and corresponding attractor fields of energy. We talked earlier about how we magnetize or we attract things that resonate with how we view the world. Well, we could say that if we imagine a scale from 0 to 1,000, where 1,000 is a complete, embodied, and integrated understanding that I am that I am, that there is one source, one spirit, and one substance that makes up the entire universe, and that I am an individuated strand of that totality, and that I am creating an experience, a phenomenological experience, based on the subconscious, conscious, and superconscious belief systems that I ascribe to. And at 1,000, I have the full embodied knowing of that, which also means I have the full authority to command substance to move according to the spirit. That's what we call manifesting. So let's say at 1,000 on this imaginary scale, at 1,000, I have that much authority in my electromagnetism that I could command water molecules to become wine molecules. Or I could command water molecules to hold me up when I'm walking along the surface. At the opposite end of the scale, at 0 on this imaginary scale, there is no scale, by the way, right? These are non-existing units.
Yeah.
But let's just pretend that there is such a thing as a linear line of consciousness. At the bottom of that scale, 0, we have a complete denial of truth, a denial of love. No understanding of connectedness, no space for divinity. This is a nihilistic outlook of despair, where there is no hope and there is no point. At this level, you cannot command the elements to do anything for you. You are likely to drown if you try and walk upon the water. In the middle, around 500 or so, we have a phenomenally powerful presence. This is a log of consciousness that might not be able to command the water molecules to hold you up. You might not have that level of trust in yourself as a universal creator. But you might have the idea that you can swim as far as you want if only you set your mind to it. You might have the idea that the Lord will provide, and that, whoo, here comes a ship. Or here comes someone with a helicopter. You remember that famous parable with when God sends the helicopter, and then he sends the boat, and then he sends the sailboat. And and you're available for that, right? That's a log of consciousness where we're moving towards that more as a collective on this planet now. The sort of space in our mind and in our vibration where we have a phenomenal amount of sovereignty, where we're not likely to drown when it starts raining. We're not likely to start pouring out into the streets with pickforks and Molotov cocktails because we didn't like the incumbent president who was inaugurated that day. We're much less likely to succumb to strands and or tides of energy in the collective consciousness. That's where we need to be if we want to choose a lineage or a path to walk. If we want to say, I'm going to be a Christian, or I'm going to be a Buddhist, or I'm going to be whatever it is that you say you want to be, but you still want to be free and available to a coordinated mission to make the world a better place, and you want to be available for that commission, which might mean you might need to move in between different energy fields. You might need to sit and dine with someone that 2 weeks ago you thought was the embodiment of the Antichrist, right? You can't do that if you're stuck in a box.
Right.
So sovereignty, really, to be truly sovereign, it does require you to be so liberated in your mind and in your energy and in your body that you can move in between different lineages, even between different industries, different cultures, even different timelines. You need to be willing to let go of the plan that you had made for yourself if you are called in a different direction.
You're right. And that piques a bit of my curiosity. How sovereignty is one of those words that some people will use in the context that you're using it in, and then some people will use it in more of a term akin to the nihilism you were explaining. I'm sovereign. I'm free to do whatever I want. I go sideways if I want to. This kind of starts to cross into the world, and we don't have to go too mired into this if you don't want to, but I'm very curious of how your world of sovereignty squares the circle of free will. Where does free will fit into that? What's the moral accountability? What's are we just playing sort of like vibrational bumper cars?
Oh, that's brilliant. Brilliant, brilliant question. So free will is a universal truth. That is something that theologically is generally accepted in most schools of thought, right? That at a meta level, at the level of the monad or the Christ consciousness, the aspect of us that is the closest to truth, at that level, we have the freedom of choice. We have the ability to choose love or not choose love, to create this or to create that. Having said that, it takes a sovereign mindset to realize freedom of choice, to realize freedom of mind. And most of the time, as humans, we are not being free. We are acting according to what the constructs and the limitations that we've chosen to make agreement with, and we've made covenants with what's possible and what's not possible for us.
Right.
So in a 3D universe where cause and effect rule over synchronicity, for example, where you can't buy that house until you've made that money, and you can't make that money until you've worked those hours, and you can't work those hours until you've got those qualifications, et cetera, et cetera. That's a linear world of cause and effect.
Right.
In that world, there's such a thing as energetic bumper cars, where I'm trying to manifest mine, you're trying to manifest yours, never the twain shall meet. And this is also the world where we innately always will be in relation with one another, because we are entangled, aren't we? We agree on a meta level that we are one, that we are part of one unified field, and we're therefore entangled with one another on a quantum level, which means that we will affect one another. What you're doing must affect me, and what I'm doing must affect you. What's happening on the other side of the galaxy must affect the quality of the water I'm about to drink. And that interrelationality is one of the primordial characteristics of God. We can never get away from that. So is there such a thing as perfect, pure free will where anything I choose is absolutely unaffected by anything anyone else ever chooses?
And then subsequently not affect anybody in the future.
Right. I don't believe so.
You're no, right.
I don't believe so. I think we all have to agree that relationality being a fundamental part of a process reality, a process universe, relationality is always going to exist. Quantum entanglement is a proven fact.
Right.
However, as a 3D human in relationship with a higher self, if we want to call it that, a version of me that is sovereign over this 3D version of me, which is the part of me that's in evolution, that's processing things, that's figuring out this extremely bizarre life we have here.
Right.
There is a relationship between me and my path and what I want to manifest and my goals and dreams and who I think I am and who I think you are, and the higher version that is a part of that coordinated and integrated reality. This is a version of me that is not making up what I think I want, but has already opted into a network of goodwill, benevolence, beauty, love, being good and doing good.
So then that begs my question. So then is fundamentally the cornerstone of the moral framework then just essentially the golden rule? And it's not much of a moral framework beyond that?
Thank you for sticking with us. We hope you're enjoying the episode. We'd like to take this time to talk to our sponsor for this week, Tony Barrett from Barrett Realty.
Thank you, brother. I really appreciate you having us on the show. Barrett Realty has been in business for 20 years, and we are a boutique real estate company. And I look forward to servicing our community with people that want to buy and sell property. I think it's very important that we're out there advocating for personal property rights. And we want to be the people that you select when it comes to buying and selling homes. So please, if you're interested in buying or selling homes in Manatee, Sarasota, or surrounding counties, reach out to us at Barrett Realty at 941-745-9999 or brmovesyou.com.
Again, we'd like to send a big thanks out to Tony Barrett, Barrett Realty, for sponsoring this episode and being an awesome part of this community. Please enjoy the rest.
Well, I'm going to go to Jesus' teachings on that, because I think that the simpler we can get, the closer to truth we'll be, right? Mm. The truth is actually too simple to understand.
That's the Occam's razor.
Right. That's why we make complicated things like philosophies to try and understand truth, because it's so, so simple. But what Jesus was trying to get across to us is that God is love. And everyone of love is of God. In fact, that's a word for word verse in the Bible. It really is as simple as that. The true nature of reality is what we call love. That's how we can affirm it. It's how we can know it. That's how we can know the difference between truth and falsehood, because we all kind of agree with one another that the truth is love and love is the truth. So Jesus says that, he gives us two commissions, really, or two commandments. The first and the greatest commandment, as you say, is the golden rule. Love God, love yourself, love others. In other words, be love. Embody it. Walk it. Speak it. Smile at the cashier when you're checking out at Publix.
Right.
Even if she doesn't smile at you first, you can still be love.
Or looks like you, like you're a weirdo afterwards.
Right. Smile at her anyway.
Yeah.
You know, so that's number one is be love. And then the second thing that Jesus says, and he doesn't say this to everybody, right? This isn't something he's saying to the 5,000. This is something he says to his closest 12, his chosen ones. And he says this inside the upper room. They lock the doors, they sit around the table, they look at the plans, they're scratching their heads, they're poring over charts. And he says, go out and do love. Not just be love, not just love, but there's an operational command as well. He says, as my Father has sent me, I am now sending you. In other words, he's saying, as the source of all creation has authorized me in this body, in this lifetime, to hold the spiritual authority of God himself as a creator, in that same way, I am authorizing you to go out and to hold that same level of authority and that same commission to be a creator of love. And he says, go out into all the world and tell people that we're free. We're free of karma. We don't have to worry if I think a bad thought, a bad thing is going to happen to me. No, grace is sovereign over karma. You're free of your intergenerational curses. Oh, my grandmother told me that men were bad, and so now I believe that men are bad. You're free of all of your past lives that are unreconciled. Oh, but I was burnt at the stake as a witch back in the 1500s. You're free of all of that. None of your epigenetic diseases are sovereign over you. None of the things that Stacy said to you in third grade are sovereign over you. Not Mercury retrograde doesn't have to ruin your electronics just because the mainstream spiritual media says it's Mercury retrograde, so now your electronics are going to all die.
What do you think the operative part is for people to not be able to harness those thoughts from going astray? Because what you just listed off, it's funny, but it's all too true.
Yeah.
What do you think the reason is so many people have the problem with thoughts like that getting astray and taking over?
It's that entanglement we talked about earlier. You know, we are let's pretend we're in a body of water, and let's pretend that there are currents and there are shifting currents that move along. It's extremely difficult not to be swept along with those currents. You feel an energy rising in you, and we internalize that. That's the animal part of us. We make everything about ourselves. We take everything personally.
Right.
And we identify with everything. So we feel the shifting current. We feel, let's say there's a rise of collective anger. Let's say some planets align. Let's say some president is elected. Let's say something occurs out there in our shared reality and there's a wave of energy as a response to that. I feel that wave of energy. And if I am not sovereign, then I will internalize that and I will think that I am angry. And then because I am angry, now my vibration has shifted, which means my narrative has shifted as well. So now I'm thinking about the things I'm angry about.
Right.
I can't believe my husband did the thing, blah, blah, blah. And I create a story that matches the vibration that I'm feeling. If I am sovereign and I've embodied that level of consciousness that we're talking about, where you have such an awareness of who you really are, entangled or not inside this shifting current, then you can sense these shifting energies and you can be buoyant upon it as opposed to drowning in it, you know. So it's got everything to do with awareness, with self-awareness. There's this little story I like to tell. Have I got time for a little story?
Most definitely.
Great. Okay, so let's pretend that there's a pond. Do you know anything about dragonflies?
Yep, I grew up in the Midwest.
Oh, so good.
We had them.
You had dragons. Yeah. You've seen them whizzing and whipping around,
yes,
haven't you?
They're awesome.
They're so awesome. Well, they lay their eggs in the pond. And then the eggs sort of float down into the murky, gloopy depths at the bottom, and that's where they hatch. And we'll call them nymphs. That's the real name for a dragonfly larva, is a nymph. And at the bottom of the pond, it's thick and it's gloopy, and from time to time it'll sort of belch some sort of gas from below, and then everyone at the bottom there is going to get covered in this gloopy gloop. Well, these little nymphs, of course, can't stay down there because they'll never become a dragonfly down there. So they begin to ascend. And they'll ascend up through the different layers of water where water gets steadily clearer, maybe a little bit more lighter, maybe a little bit cleaner. And the nymphs will find their way all the way up through these ascending layers in the pond until they're at the surface. they cannot make it through the surface by themselves because there's too much counter pressure. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, right?
Right.
So if we're all called forth in life, we're all sort of called forward progression, right? We all make agreement with a progression in life. We all make agreement with ascension in consciousness and a desire to move deeper into truth, right? So that means there's also a counter pressure that pushes against that. And we can imagine that as that the surface of the water that separates the watery dimension below from the airy dimension above. There's completely two completely different dimensional realities. Never the twain shall meet. And if you're a nymph at the bottom of that pond, you simply cannot imagine what life might be like as a dragonfly.
Right.
You couldn't imagine it. But neither can you deny the innate urge to find out. There's no one down there orchestrating or organizing the ascension of these nymphs. It's just occurring. It's an innate natural metamorphosis that they cannot escape. And so they get up to the surface, and no dragonfly larva will ever just get through the surface, will they? You can kind of visualize them poking, trying to figure out how to get through the surface, and they can't, they won't. So what they do is they make their way to a blade of grass or a reed, perhaps, or a lily pad or something like that. They'll make their way from something to something that grows all the way from the bottom, all the way up through every layer in the pond, pierces that veil, and then grows up into the airy dimension. And what the nymphs will do is they'll find that blade of grass and they'll ground their little feet onto that blade of grass, and then they just walk up it. They walk up the blade of grass through the surface. And at the surface, they shed what's called the excuvia, which is like the dragonfly version of a cocoon, right? It's the old body that the nymph used to have when it was a nymph. Sheds that, and then it becomes a dragonfly. But it doesn't just fly off from the surface of the pond. It continues walking up that blade of grass until it reaches the tip. Now it's acclimatized to a new dimension. Now it can fly. So these are some of the dynamics that we all will encounter on this strange journey as we ascend in consciousness and as we reclaim more of our divine inheritance and as we embody more of the authority that we hold by our natural divine birthright as essence of the divine, right? As strands of that infinite field that we all agree is true. In the body of water, we're all going to be swept away by these different currents. And one of the greatest errors, I might even go as far as to say sins of the world, is that we convince ourselves that we are independent and that we have to do it on our own. And that me as a little nymph, I have to figure out how to get through that surface, that I have to be the one who does it. Because if it's not me, then it's somehow cheating, right?
Right.
When actually it's as easy as finding a structure that's malleable, you know, because that reed, that blade of grass is never going to bend or it's never going to snap. It will bend. It'll bend with the currents. If the energies go this way, it'll bend. If the energies go that way, it'll bend, but it'll never snap. And the other thing to know is that the nymph who is following that blade of grass is sovereign over the shifting currents in the pond, because it doesn't matter what occurs in the pond, it's not going to affect whether or not that nymph becomes a dragonfly.
Right. So do you see that sovereignty, whether we're tomato or tomatoing it, is sort of a jumpstart to a pathway of freedom to have the self-discipline to find your blade of grass?
I think sovereignty may be the jumpstart and the process and the result, honestly. I think true sovereignty is the embodiment of the quest, right? We all kind of have a sense of we don't know where we're going, but we know we're going there. We know we're going that way. We know we're going deeper into God, right?
But without some self-assuredness, you get taken with the current instead of being able to find your structure.
Correct. That's why the universe is encoded with what we can call Messiah. There is such a thing as Savior. And one of the reasons we have Savior, we have that, let's think of it as a mechanism, if we want. We can think of it as a universal mechanism, an intercession field, something that exists for the purpose of saving us when we fall, of hoisting us up out of that sludgy bottom of the pond when we didn't mean to fall down in it. I wasn't expecting to get so angry when that thing happened. I didn't mean to snap. Have I really set off a karmic ripple effect that's going to bounce back at me and make me have a bad day tomorrow? Not necessarily. If I lean on my savior, if I accept that I have a personal savior, I have a personal access to a companion, to a friend, to someone who has all of the spiritual mastery that I'm deficient in, let's say, then that mechanism becomes available to me. Phenomenologically, we say that we create what we believe, right?
Yeah. If you see it in your head, you can hold it in your hand.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. So if I believe, if I choose to believe that I have a personal savior, that I have access to that, then that's what's going to manifest for me when in those inevitable times where I'm not going to act in a sovereign way. So yes, self-awareness and sovereignty is the mastery that we are honing and developing, right? As ones who have chosen to be following the golden rule and on this operative commission to make the world a little bit better. We do need to develop our sovereignty and our mastery in that regard. But we don't have to wait for that to be complete before we can say that we are free. We are already free by the nature of this innate Messiah. And in the Christian theology, we will say that because of what Jesus Christ did on the cross, because of that act of self-sacrifice, that was the embodiment of the very nature of God becoming manifest for the human consciousness. A bit like, you know, how Roger Bannister, do you know him?
I don't.
Let's say about 100 years ago, nobody could run a 4-minute mile.
Oh,
right?
I know this story. Yeah. Very much know this story. One of my favorites.
Yeah. It can't be done.
Yeah.
You cannot run a 4-minute mile. Can't be done.
And now grade school kids do it every day.
Because he did it first, right?
Yep.
He did it. So he deposited into the human potential a precedent for what the human body can do.
Right.
He did it, completed it. Now it's available for everybody. It's like the thousandth monkey. That's another good story about that.
Yep.
The same exact thing occurred when Jesus Christ embodied human divine form and then completed the thing, which was an ontological process of actions from his birth through his ministry, through his sacrifice and death, then ascension, and then deposited into the human consciousness, the collective consciousness, or Akash, as some people know it.
Yes.
The potential for that perfect level of sovereignty and grace. That makes us now, it frees us now from all karmic binds.
And I don't mean to cut you off, but that seems to be a very operative point, because that's sort of that's the ultimate get of it. This is if the plan worked out the way it was written on paper perfectly. I don't know that I've heard it put more succinctly, and I appreciate you for doing that. How come there had to be dogma attached to that? And where in the sovereign principle of it do these types of dogmas lie or not lie? Because that framework you said is great, but then we start and then no one gets in the box.
Yeah. We can't help ourselves. We ought not to create dogmatic squares and rituals and practices and languages and cultures. But we can't help ourselves.
What's with that?
What is that? It's relatability is what that is. You know, we want to communicate with one another about the things that we know to be true.
But it somehow smacks of gatekeeping to this ultimate prize you just described, a more divine consciousness.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, like who owns the truth?
Exactly.
Yeah, whose truth is the truest?
Exactly.
Yeah. That's, again, relatable to this imaginary scale that we've got here from 0 to 1,000.
Right.
Around at 200, we have the level of neutrality. This is where you begin to live a life of integrity. You begin to stand for your core values and you know who you are. You're still pretty neutral in your view of life. Your attitude might be a little bit like, well, you win some, you lose some. The sun will probably rise tomorrow. It's always risen so far. This is a level of consciousness where you don't have much authority or power to impact the world, but you could nonetheless appreciate the goodness of a sunrise.
Mm.
From 200 to 500, we have a benevolent attitude, but one that is nonetheless linear, a dualistic mindset where there is right and there is wrong, there is up and there is down, there is cause and there is effect, and we are bound by the laws of classical physics.
Right.
From 500 and up, we have a much more quantum mindset. This is a mindset where synchronicity rules. Like you say, you needed someone on the show that could fill a certain spot, and then boom, there they were, the perfect candidate. That's because you're operating in a different log of consciousness from the one that is very strictly linear. The religiousness that you're talking about, the religiosity, which isn't confined to the main religions. We see it even in mainstream spirituality. Religiosity is when we believe in a linear reality where this must be fulfilled in order for this result to be seen. But in higher logs of consciousness, that all falls away. So you can have a Catholic bishop who has a fantastic understanding of quantum reality and a perfect expression of magic and an incredible level of genius. And you can have that in any school of thought and any religion. It's all got to do with your log of consciousness.
Yeah, and that's where you get into the weighty waters. You said a word twice that I love, synchronicity. And I like to ask people, it's strange when it comes up. I guess I could say it's coincidental, but it isn't, because my answer to this question is I don't. Do you believe in coincidence?
For the longest time, I would have said no. Everything is coordinated. Everything is known. There is perfect order to absolutely everything, which means if something occurred, it's because it was divinely orchestrated in some way. And maybe I do still believe that, you know, maybe I'm not going to counter that because I do believe in that there is a sovereign hand upon my life. I do feel I feel his presence in my mind and in my heart. I believe that I am where I'm supposed to be whenever I'm there. But there's something romantic about the idea of a complete and utter accident.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe those three doves that just landed in front of me, maybe they don't mean anything. Maybe they're just pigeons. Like, isn't that a wacky thought? And I think most people on this path have read The Alchemist,
mm-hmm,
by Paulo Coelho. Are you familiar with
it? I'm not.
Well, in The Alchemist, there's the protagonist, the main guy, has to go through the journey that we all go through in order to realize what the treasure is and where to find it. Along the way, he first has to come into the awareness of the symbols, right? The symbols, the signs and symbols. What does obsidian mean? What does a ring upon a ring mean? And if you see two blue butterflies that morning, what does it mean? What does it all mean about me, right? We have to personalize and internalize everything. Then after a while, throughout his journeys, he begins to realize the true language of the universe. And he understands that the symbols that he's seen and all those synchronicities along the way, that, well, in fact, they didn't mean anything. They were simply substantial, particularized forms that help us make sense of the inner language or the living word, which in Greek is rhema. The living word, not the not graphos, the written word, but the rhema, the living word. That's where the language of God is. And we can use religions and ontologies and symbols and signs and synchronicities. We can use these things to arrange and sort out our understanding. But really, in and of itself, the tarot cards can't tell you anything. The planets can't tell you anything. The synchronicities can't really tell you anything about who you truly are and who God is. Only the living word in your heart can. But isn't it delightful to find ourselves in the things of the world, in the manifestations all around us?
Yes, absolutely. And it is so tempting to discount things like that as coincidence or put maybe too much weight into them. That's why I'm always curious to see where everybody lies on that one.
Right.
You mentioned something when we first started talking that I want to kind of cycle back to, and that was the innate things that are maybe obvious to us all, or we all feel in certain degrees for certain reasons at certain times in our lives. One of them that you've brought up that I think a lot of people can relate to is the interconnectedness of things. I think even if you've spent your whole life maybe trying to ignore it, there's still been one point in your life where you've had that feeling like maybe we are all one.
Mm.
I'm curious what you think some of the more obvious evidence or some of the more compelling evidence for those types of feelings are. And I'm also curious what you think some of the big distractions we have now are that are keeping people maybe from seeing some of these things with some of the clarity we maybe had years and years ago.
I mean, the evidence that, so you asked me two questions here. The first yep. question you asked me was, what is the evidence really for interconnectedness, right? Can I synthesize your question down to that?
Yes, 100%.
What is the proof that we are interconnected? The only proof that means anything is the experiential proof. It's
right.
the feeling that you have and the way that you see the witness that you bring to it. And of course, we see the signs and wonders. They emerge naturally when we reach the higher logs of consciousness. Miracles just emerge naturally for us when we say, see, there's the proof. I said the thing and then you showed up with the whatnot, right? There's the proof. It's experiential. Of course, there's scientific proof as well. We know quite a lot about the unified field. And string theory has gone a very long way to show us that actually, the entire universe is just one vast fabric of sound, of moving energy, and that the manifest universe as we see it is in fact vibrations of many different frequencies and densities. We already know that. So
I was going to say, do you think part of that is our meat vehicle feels that water vibrating? The water in us feels that vibration.
Yeah, kinesiology is one practice that can help people discern truth from falsehood. It's actually a moving energy, the energy in our body. Right? When we're in the presence of truth, we strengthen, and when we're in the presence of falsehood, we weaken. Hmm. And so we have techniques like muscle testing, for example, that doctors and practitioners all over the world do to test whether or not you're suitable for this supplement or whether this food is good or bad for you, for example. They'll test the power in your body to ascertain the level of truth. And that's the same technique that Dr. Hawkins and his researchers used to calibrate the map of consciousness, or the scale that I mentioned from 0 to 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
So the waters in our bodies respond to the gravity of the moon, and we can sense it.
Right.
The hairs on our body respond to the frequencies in and around us. Someone walks in, even if you don't see the person, you still have a sense of who they might be in relation to you because of how their energy is affecting your energy. So experientially, we feel it in all kinds of different ways. I had a friend who used to get a metallic taste in her mouth whenever someone was lying. Isn't that interesting? So each one of us will be raised up to discern truth and falsehood, to discern the interconnectedness and the entanglement that we all live in. We'll be raised up in through our lineages, through our cultures, to understand that and prehend that in a unique way. Yes, so your first question was, what's the evidence that we're connected?
And my second question was, what are some of the things you feel are distracting us most from noticing these things?
In this day and age, okay, so our distractions, and let me go back to the point I made earlier about counterforce. There is innate counterforce in universal reality. So just as expansion is a universal truth, contraction is also a universal truth. And we experience that counterforce, we experience that as negative. You know, if we have positive, then we have negative. That's a very dualistic way of saying it, but it helps us understand it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Another word we can use is good and evil. And we can sense and discern the difference between those two forces. How are they? Are they elevating and edifying, or are they depressing and depleting? And we can sort of make sense of those different forces and how they manifest for us. And how counterforce manifests depends on our log of consciousness. And as a collective, we've gone through different ages of consciousness. For example, 2,000 years ago, during the time of the birth of Jesus, the collective consciousness calibrated at 175 on that imaginary scale, which meant they were below 200, which meant they were net negative. So by the law of attraction, what's occurring is more negative experiences, thoughts, feelings, energies, creating a downward spiral, which is what plunges entire civilizations into catastrophe. So what occurred when Jesus was born and when he was manifest was he flipped the scales, because there was a perfect 1,000 on that scale, creating enough electromagnetism to raise that, to invert that downward spiral and create ascension instead, thus saving the entirety of the human experience from spiritual annihilation. And so at that level, counterforce manifests as anger, rage, control, the need for power. And then we moved into darker times during the Middle Ages, when counterforce manifested as pungent rot and shame.
And we took 1,000 years off.
Blah. What a dark time. Yeah. We took 1,000 years off to kind of reconcile some of these energies that had been denied for a very, very long time. They all had to be purged, and they were. They were brought up to the surface to be seen and known and reclaimed at a higher calibration. Then we moved into the industrial era, into the Age of Enlightenment, where counterforce appeared as imperialism. Right. I want, I will have, I will take, I control, I own. I'm bigger than you, I'm stronger than you, I'm much more impressive than you. Everyone says so, millions of people, etc. Nowadays, recently, in the last century, in the do we say 2000s? We'll forget that.
Yeah.
The world wars, for example, were expressions of counterforce at the most extraordinary level of rage and control, if you like. And now what we're seeing is a whole new expression of counterforce. It's not so much about rage or shame. Now we're looking at glamour and vanity,
right,
and pride. And the way that evil is manifesting now is as deep fake split realities, where everybody needs to be convinced that I have my truth and my truth is my truth. So now we have these phenomenological universes, 8 billion of them, where everyone's manifesting their own little universe. Everyone's got their own little truth. And what's more, we're able to manifest really fast, which means we're manifesting and seeing and confirming the reality that we're claiming for ourselves, which sounds fantastic, except if that reality is driven by cognitive dissonance, or by...
Which it is,
let's be honest.
Yeah.
Or by exquisitely sophisticated artificial intelligence with realities that are fake yet projected as real, so glamorous, so exciting, so thrilling. That's going to be the biggest distraction for us moving forward. This idea that I can be, do, and have anything I want. A dangerous idea for a consciousness that's convinced that its own sovereignty means its independence.
Right. And then that begs the question, is there a precedent for, or does it seem counterintuitive to be at a time where we have 8 billion people all trying to seek the high ground on reality?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sorry, give me that as a question again.
Is it counterintuitive, or are we now... You give people all this freedom so they can have the freedom of thought, get to these places, right? But invariably, some of these people take it to where it's all about me. Mm-hmm. And now in my corner of reality, everything I think is true and you people are all nuts.
Yeah.
Do you think that the pendulum is swinging too far the other way, or is it just a natural occurrence to want to have people who... I don't know any way to put it, to fancy themselves enlightened, to then want to try to take a monopoly on reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is the way we're going. That's where the pendulum is swinging. We all woke up and went, okay, so I'm not enslaved anymore. Oh, so I am actually a spark of the divine.
Right.
Oh, so I do have authority to make claims for myself and my life and what I want to experience. So I do have the worth and the ability to make something for myself. That's the beginning of awakening, and it's the beginning of sovereign power. But when it swings too far the other way, and we forget the fundamental truth of God, which is that we're relational, we need each other. Not one of us is designed to make it through the surface by ourselves. We must have one another. In fact, Jesus is God with us. The name Emmanuel is Hebrew for God with us. There's the with is very important there. That's different from I am God. It's very different from I am God. God with us is not God in me or God up there. It is God with us.
Right.
So the connected, the interconnectedness is what will save us from the inevitable downfall that comes from pride.
So at the beginning, you're just like we're in toddler with a flamethrower.
Yep.
Status.
Uh-huh. Yeah, like that. Yeah.
Okay, I want to ask you one somewhat pointed question, and then we can get you out of here on something fun. For people who are trying to, I don't want to necessarily adhere, but be conscious of this conscious scale to 0 of 1,000, what are some of the things you find that people can make as habits or practices they can make, even amongst this loud, distracting world, where we can feel comfortable trying to ratchet up that scale by our own means and our own metrics, but at least know we're moving forward? What habits help us solidify and grow our consciousness?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. You know, the habits and the practices that help us do depend on our personality construct. Some people will respond better to reflection and journaling and writing things down, metacognition, thinking about thinking. Who is actually making the decisions that I'm making? What are my core values and where do I stand in relation to them? And others will do better with more visceral or sensory practices like breathing techniques or walking in the woods. Really, it all comes back to connectedness. Mm. How do I connect? Do I connect best when I'm out there amongst people, or do I connect best when I'm in my own inner space? You know, so...
Is it just intuition? I don't mean to cut you off, but is it just intuition that helps someone recognize which side of the fence they may be falling on?
Intuition can help. So can your friends. You know, I'm not one of those people who says that the truth is only buried deep inside your heart. I think the truth is also out among us, with us. So the people who love you will reflect back to you what sort of a person you are. Breathing will always help you. Drinking water will always help you. Putting your feet on the ground will always help you. And taking a moment to ask yourself, do I know who I am now? Do I know where I am now? And orienting yourself to the landscape around you. That's the beginning, right, of freedom, is to know who you are and where you are.
Yeah, you can't go anywhere if you don't know where you're starting, I suppose.
I believe that, yeah.
All right, well, here's your fun one. I've been asking people this one lately, and I think you're the perfect candidate for it. If I gave you 10,000 billboards to put across the United States right now, they all have to say one thing. What would you put on your billboard?
God is with us, and I am sovereign.
Nice. Well, Elizabeth, I can't tell you how grateful I am to hear from you. I think we need to do this again.
And, yes, please.
Yes, and I think we need to introduce you to some of our other guests that I think we can maybe have a panel discussion that would be a lot of fun and enlightening. So again, I appreciate you taking the time. I'm so grateful to hear from you. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you for having me buy my book.
Yes, absolutely. We'll have the book on display.
Thank you.
Yep.